Welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. When I think high achiever, I often think control. Not in a bad way, just more on top of all things and moving forward consistently, even if that forward movement is slowish at times. My guest today is a high achiever. He took a family business to impressive heights and then, in his 50s, sold it to live a wonderful leisure life. Well, after the honeymoon period was over, Jack realized that freedom without purpose can feel more like drifting than liberation, his words. He rose to the challenge and went about solving for both himself and others like himself. Jack and I chat for about an hour, and along the way, I realize that Jack's business may be directed at high achievers, but everyone can follow his advice and insights. Listen now to my conversation with Jack Calhoun. A number of guests on this podcast talk to us about transitioning from the 9 to 5. Some of us don't. We stay on for a number of years because we can. Some, like me, think a job being a Walmart greeter would suit us just fine. Set hours, lots of socialization, and you never take the job home with you. Others struggle to figure out a life when they realize gardening and pickleball aren't really a full-time lifestyle, at least not a satisfactory one. And that's where my guest today comes in. Some of us feel our identity lies in our position, the title on the door. I'll hazard a guess that high achievers might struggle more than many to replace the prestige, the significance, the impact of their professional lives when they leave their, well, probably not 9 to 5, maybe they're 8 to 8. Now, Jack is one of those high achievers. When he sold his very successful wealth management firm, he found, in his own words, that freedom without purpose can feel more like drifting than liberation. As a high achiever, however, he accepted the challenge and created Encore Career Lab. Listen in. He has a lot of insights and guidance to share. Jack Calhoun, welcome to the podcast for Boomer Women, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you, Agnes. I'm honored to be here. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
I am too. I'm really curious about this. Tell us about your transition after selling your business from the expectation to the reality, because you were quite young.
Relative to, I guess retirement as we expected, I was about 50, and I was in wealth management for about 20-ish years, maybe 23 or something. I was actually a creative type. I was a journalism major and more of a communications person, but I also knew that I was, I was kind of that ADD type. I was never going to be employed by any person for long because I couldn't sit still behind a desk on their terms. So I had to find my own way, and my own way was my father, who also was very much like me, and he had a small investment business. He had started it after leaving a brokerage firm, and so I went over with him basically to do the business development and kind of learn the business on the fly. And it was good work. I was proud of the work we did. We grew a lot during a very difficult time, which was the 2000s, and I think it was by doing things ethically in a kind of a high integrity way. And Dad retired in the mid 2000s, and myself and my other partners bought him out, and I became the majority owner of the company at that point. And so, about 2013 or 14, there was a lot of consolidation in the industry, a lot of M&A and private equity coming in to roll up firms. And so they started making offers for us. And I had not really thought about leaving that career. But at the same time, I never woke up every day when I was 8 years old wanting to be a registered investment advisor, right? And so, I guess being a creative type, I kind of thought, well, maybe this is a good time to take some chips off the table and move on and go reinvent myself. And, I'm a creative guy. This will be fun. And boy, was I naive. I was not the type of what I would consider the super type A that worked 7 days a week and, morning to night. And on my deathbed, I would regret not spending more time with my family and all that. I felt like I had a balanced life. And, for me, my family was at the top of my value system. And, I was fortunate to be in an industry that didn't require insane hours. So it was a nice life. And so I didn't think that I had that much of my identity wrapped up in my career. I didn't live and die by the bottom line and all that. But what I underestimated, I think, for people who are, use the term high achievers, I think myself and everybody else who is one maybe doesn't like that term because it sounds self-aggrandizing, I guess. But I think it's people who are, I call, career invested, right? It's people for whom your work means a lot to you and your identity. And when you are career invested, it is very disorienting when that goes away. And it's kind of a multifaceted dislocation. Part of it is, not, knowing how to answer the question, what do you do, right? And that's really disorienting, even if you've, had a happy event like selling a company. Right. And just saying I'm retired is a little bit of a conversation killer sometimes. Right. And I never really intended to be retired. I just didn't know what I was going to be next. I thought that that would be a fun, unscripted, spontaneous thing for me to figure out. And that was my big, I guess, mistake or my learning experience. And then the other part is the structure and the community that comes with your career. Right. And a lot of times we bristle at the structure after a point in time, right? We're ready for a change. We're tired of the routine. But then it all goes away, and suddenly you're completely unstructured and completely unmoored from your daily routine. And then you're disconnected from your people. And, some people maybe we're ready to be disconnected from, but others are mean a lot to us. And in my case, although we managed a considerable amount of money for people, our company was small. We had about 15 people. You don't need that many people to manage money these days. And so it was a very family-like atmosphere. And so I missed that more than I expected. I was focusing on things that I was looking forward to not having to deal with anymore, and I wasn't really focused on the things I was going to really miss, right? So, the other thing that I found is that when you can do anything, how do you define what anything is, right? And it's a first world problem for sure. It's a nice problem to have. A lot of people never get that luxury. So I'm cognizant of the certain amount of privilege that goes with that. But people who have been invested in their careers struggle with that. And it's this paradox of choice. It's so many things you could do that you end up kind of worried. Well, if I choose this one thing, what about all these 50 other things I could do, right? And how do you decide what to go all in on and really make it your next thing? And a lot of analysis paralysis comes with that. And so I kind of coined the phrase wondering and wandering period, which was what for me was years, where you kind of dabble with things. In the South, we say piddle with things, as my grandmother used to say, and they're kind of fun, but it stays kind of surface, and you don't really invest in it like you did in your first career. And then there's a point where you're like, I've really got to figure out what my next thing is. And for me, there was an epiphany there after some going down some paths that were ultimately not well suited for me, that seemed interesting on the front end, that I thought, there really needs to be a process and a structure to this experience. There needs to be a framework that people can go through when they're leaving their career behind to get them oriented for this, what is essentially a third act of our lives. And in a lot of ways, we're the first generation to really be grappling with it. Younger boomers, older Gen Xers, our parents and grandparents never dealt with this. They didn't have the luxury of dealing with it. Most of them weren't in great health. Maybe some were, but there was no way to really create a third act for yourself as like an encore career, as I like to call it, because it was pretty much big companies and, before the last 20 years, right? And there wasn't remote technology and things like that. So if you weren't working for a big company or you didn't own a hardware store, then that was pretty much what it was. You didn't have a lot of things you could do, right? And people viewed their 60s and 70s and certainly their 80s as the wind down time, And I don't think we're looking at it that way anymore. And so the world sort of needs a new framework, I think. And I guess in our small way, that's what I'm trying to give people.
Well, I will go back briefly to when you said that people say, "What do you do?" And you say you're retired, and that's a conversation killer. I recently interviewed a woman whose phrase was, "I'm retired and killing it."
I saw
Yeah,
that.
now that opened up
Well,
conversations
that's a
for
good
her.
way to start it. Yeah, I like her
There we
chutzpah.
go. Now, I also found it interesting that and I was curious going in that, you get used to, as a professional, what you do at your in your career, what you offer to people. But it sounds like too part of what you realized was that you were an important part of that business. So because of your experience, your knowledge, people would come to you for that, and suddenly you're not even getting that, so.
Very much so. And that part I didn't factor in. I thought, well, I'm going to sell a company and I'll be compensated for that and life will be great. And I distinctly remember I go on a fishing trip with some friends every year, about 10 guys that I've known for a long time. And we go down to Florida and do some light tackle fishing and sit around the lodge at the end of the day and carry on a bit. And inevitably it turns to work talk, and these are folks, a lot of them are from Atlanta where I grew up, and people who are high achievers and attorneys and physicians and CEOs and things like that, and people just climb the ladder, and now they're kind of in their 50s and near the top. And so it's a high level discussion, and that was after I sold the company. I remember one night sitting over kind of off to the side having an existential crisis while everybody was talking and carrying on, because I realized I didn't have anything to add to the conversation. I was effectively out of the game, and that was disorienting to me. And I'm sure there's some ego and some pride in there, and it's probably good that I went through that, because it forced me to reassess my values at that point of life. But it didn't happen all at once. Mostly, it started with that sort of, who am I? What am I now? Kind of feeling, right? In the sense that you used to provide high level, input and advice and counsel to people that valued it and valued you. And now that's done. And now what do you have to offer? Now who needs you, right? Besides your family.
Well, but do you also understand that because you were, shall we say, an early adopter, you did this younger than many people do it, that all those buddies of yours on that fishing trip in, I don't know, 5, 6 years, who knows? I don't know what age you guys all are, but you are going to be the go-to person because they're going to be the one struggling, and you're the one now that's been through it. You're acing it. And you've got the know-how, the skills, all that stuff that they're going to be
I've
looking
got the
for.
experience.
No, exactly. And what's better than hard-won experience?
You're right. And that was kind of part two, right? So part one was this. Oh, I need to figure out my next act. I don't know who I am. I don't know what I need, what people need me for. And so what I find is that people who have been career invested are very anxious to jump into the what, right? When people say, what do? You want to have an answer. And it can lead us to maybe some ill-advised decisions in order to be able to answer that, right? Something's intriguing on the front end, an opportunity, a path. And then we get into it, and then we find out it's not all that. And we got to kind of back ourselves out of it. And I think that's where, I realized that, it happened to me. And I realized all of those friends I had, just to your point, at some point in about 5 to 10, 12 years, they were going to face it too. And if they were going to be facing it, there were countless other people out there facing it or going to face it. And that was when I was like, oh, okay. All right, that was my epiphany. I was like, I know exactly the program, the framework I would have liked to have had when I left my career. And I know how to reverse engineer my own experience and create the one that can save people a lot of time in this wondering and wandering phase, right? And shorten that experience from hopefully years into a few months or even weeks.
I love the term reverse engineer. It works in so many things. Now
Yeah,
I'm going to continue to use the word high achievers, not in a derisive way, in any way, shape, or
all
form,
good.
but just as
Well,
people who are very vested in what they do.
sure.
Are there any, now that you've had a few clients, any universal misconceptions about retirement amongst high achievers?
I think there is the misconception that activities can replace the career stuff. And by activities, I mean both recreational and vocational. So it can be taking trips, it can be playing golf, pickleball, whatever, as you alluded to. It can be volunteering, right? It can be hobbies, it can be passion projects. All of those are part of a balanced, healthy life. And those are the things we most definitely defer during our first career years, right? And especially family raising and career at the same time. There's not a lot of bandwidth for any of that stuff. And so we want to make room and space for that. But the part where, you do work that you are compensated for and valued for people you care about and enjoy working with, is not replaced by any of those other things. That is its own wedge of the life portfolio, so to speak. And it's important to devote ourselves to causes and volunteer work that we believe in. But those are not areas we go into expecting gratification, right? Other than feeling good that we're helping people. But we don't go in it to, feel a sense of accomplishment and worth and all of that. We're going into volunteer work because we know it's an important cause and we want to help that cause, right? And if maybe we get a plaque or some kind of acknowledgement, we're almost a little sheepish about it, right? Because we don't want it to be about us. We're trying to serve. I think with the work part, we do want to feel like we're helping and that we're moving the needle, and we do need to feel accomplished and valued. And so that's different from the other stuff. So I think I really try to get people to identify with this portfolio metaphor, probably because that's where I came from, right? Investment management and making sure you have different wedges of your life portfolio that are all sort of blending together and working together.
Now there's certain losses that you experience when you retire, air quotes, retire. There's the prestige, the significance, impact. I mentioned those earlier on. Can I add in income here as well? And I
Oh,
do
sure.
that with qualification because often or many people, when they leave that 9 to 5, they are looking to replace income because they need to. Now, with any luck, a high achiever has been earning a high enough income that, and especially if you've been in wealth management, you've got some sort of a financial plan for retirement.
Right.
But can it be almost like a habit, having that good income?
Yeah. Well, listen, I think it's on almost everybody's mind, with the exception of what I would call the ultra wealthy. Because, even if you have what most people would consider a lot of money, millions or tens of millions of dollars, if you view that as the money you're going to have for the rest of your life, then it changes your perspective on things. And all you need is an experience like we had in what they call the COVID crash, of March of 2020, or certainly the 08, 09. And all of a sudden, maybe your 5 million goes to 3 million, right? And as we used to say as advisors, don't panic, don't sell, and that's great, except that if you're living off of that portfolio for your income, then that starts diminishing that while it's down low. And so even for people that have a lot of money, certainly for people that weren't able to save as much, through no fault of their own, it's just hard to save that kind of money. Income's a thing. And I've been having conversations with my friends and colleagues in the investment industry about this too. It's, the assumptions that we use to tell people they're going to be fine, typically end with assumptions about people living to say 93. That's a very popular, number. And I was like, move that slider to 103 and see how your confidence levels hold up, right? Because we're heading there. With technology, medical advancements, people understand they're in better health. People don't smoke like they used to. People are stopping drinking like they did. People are going to live longer and be healthier. And, living 20 years off of a nest egg versus 40 years is a very different proposition. So I think it's just going to be incumbent upon everybody to try to find a way to keep income coming in, not only because it helps with the analytical part. It just helps you feel more in control and more relaxed that you're not, it proves to yourself that you're still capable of keeping, an income coming in. How much that is really up to you,
Our audience can't see us, but we can see each other. And I need to explain to you that if I grin from time to time, it was literally just a couple of hours ago that I had my year-end call with my financial advisor. So some of the things you're saying, and even that, the life expectancy thing, she said, do we need to bump this up? And I said, you better bump it up a long way. I said, because I'm going to live forever, and so far, so good. That's one of my
Yeah,
classic lines.
I love
But
it.
yeah, it
Yeah.
does make a difference, doesn't it?
So the income, the financial part is a significant part of it. I think it has to be, if you have the ability, it has to be in a way where it's work that is energizing to us, that feels, it's not that kind of grinding corporate business work that we did in our first careers. It can be an adjunct or a variation of that, but I think it's still got to be work that feels good and right to us and that we feel like we're in control of.
So, once again, I'm really generalizing here with the high achiever part, but one would sort of expect that they're so used to having a handle on all the different aspects of their business. And I'm going to extend that to say, I probably would expect that they would, because you're used to having like a finger and all the, like knowing what's going on in all those different pieces. That you would show the same oversight to the very facets of upcoming lifestyle changes. But it sounds like you're an example, and I don't think you're, I'm sorry, I hate to say this to you, I don't think you're unusual.
No,
but it sounds like it sort of, you sort of had these ideas out there, but it didn't materialize at all.
don't think I am. Yeah, it made me realize how much we miss in the wealth management, investment, financial planning, whatever you want to call it. The part where we help people with retirement planning is almost entirely oriented around, solving for X, right? We expect you to live, a certain number of years, and here's the lifestyle you want to sustain, and here's the money you need it. And if you have it, great. Bon voyage, party on, Wayne, right? And if you don't, keep working. And that's kind of what it was. And there's talk about legacy and estate, charitable and stuff like that. But it's typically oriented around, do you have the money? If so, go forth and have fun. And that was when I realized we're really missing the existential, holistic part of this, which is we're wired to need to feel like we're giving back and that we're doing things that matter to people and that we're part of community. And just moving, embracing this mentality of the, retirement as an endless vacation is really kind of a destructive mentality. It moves us into being endless consumers. And there's a fantastic book called the Longevity Economy, and I'll be happy to give it to you for show notes if you want to put it in later, by
Sure.
Joseph Coughlin, Coughlin.
I've heard of the
And he is
name.
the head of the MIT Think Lab. I mean, Age Lab, excuse me, is I believe what it's called. So he wrote this book, kind of how did we get here to this idea of this binary world of I work, I recreate, right? I work for a period of time and then I stop working and I recreate. And it's a fascinating book. It's data heavy, but it was interesting to me, especially the early part. And it talked about how this idea of retirement even came to be. And it was eye-opening to me because I'd never stopped to really think about it, but it really primarily came from the Social Security Act in the US in 1935, which was the middle of the Great Depression. And you had an extraordinarily high number of young men that were out of work, that were congregating on street corners complaining. It was the middle of the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. A lot of angst about, all of that going on in Washington. And people needed a safety net, right? So Social Security Act was created and it was very much a safety net and still is. But they put a provision in there called the earnings test that said if you want to get your benefits, you can't work anymore. You can't make any meaningful money or you're not qualified. And back then, a couple of things made that not that big a deal. One is we had, the economies in Western nations were very heavily manufacturing and agrarian, right? So physically demanding work for people. And people smoked and they were in terrible shape, typically. And life expectancy was 61 in 1935 in the US. So if you even made it to 65, you'd already beaten the odds. And then if you play golf for a couple of years or whatever your thing is and you check out, then no big deal. The numbers work. But what that did was it created this mentality in at least in the US and by extension, I think other, Canada and Western Europe, that when we turn an age, we stop working. And that became part of our cultural mindset. And it's really never stopped. And it's almost a century now. And along the way, lifespans are stretching out. And so, and this is also in the book, the Longevity Economy book, policymakers went to the industry and said, look, we got these people living longer. They're not doing anything. They're voting. They're crabby. We got to keep them entertained. And so, industry came out with this whole concept of retirement as a stage of life. And that's when you started to see the Del Webb and what we now see in the villages in Florida, these communities that are oriented around the 55 and up, nothing wrong with them. But that was the beginning of this mindset of, oh, well, I worked for that time and this is my time, my vacation time. And there's nothing wrong with enjoying ourselves and cruising and all of that. It's just a question of, is that all you're doing, right? And we were never really meant to just recreate for 30 years, right? We have to have something there that makes us feel like we're doing something that matters.
Yeah, it's interesting, just the whole change in lifespan in not that many years when you really think
No,
about it.
I know.
And I didn't know the part about going to business and saying, okay, like we got all these grumpy old people.
Sitting around and they're voting still more than ever.
Oh, dear, put those cigarettes back in their pocket, let
That's
them smoke themselves to death. Get rid of them. Okay, now you have some other statistics on your website, and I think the one that surprised me most was that Americans age, and I mean, I'm sure it's Canadians, as you say, it's most Western countries, age 65 to 74 spend an average of 4.3 hours a day watching television. That's crazy.
And I think we all see it. We know people who are up in years who are, for them it's usually cable news, right? My grandparents, the news was on all the time, and when that became even a possibility for them in the 80s. And I think that that just speaks to the void, right? And what's interesting about that chart, the one you're referencing, is it shows the total amount of time Americans spend that age group, 65 to 74, on leisure activities. And so by far, more than half is on that watching TV, right? The other parts are, recreation, leisure, travel, reading. Those are all tiny little wedges of the pie. And it's the average day, if that's a year averaged into a single typical day. And what it shows is this idea that we're going to just have this embarrassment of time to go do all these amazing things. That bucket list gets checked off faster than you think. Maybe it's a year, maybe it's two or three, but at some point you kind of been there, done there, and got the t-shirt. And then it's like, okay, well, here you go. You're 67 now or whatever. Now what? Right? And that's when that kind of void starts to stare at people, I think.
No, let's go to the opposite extreme with statistics, because you also have the statistic that Americans age 55 to 64 are now the fastest growing group of new entrepreneurs, and they're responsible for nearly 25% of all startups in recent years. Now, you're one of those people. You're one of that. Now, we may be discussing to a certain extent high achievers, but you don't need to be a high achiever to be a successful entrepreneur.
Not at all. And I think, high achievers or whatever term you want to call it, it's just people that, were heavily took their identity from what they did. But the idea of creating something that's of value to people knows no bounds. And I think that's one of the beauties of the freedom that we have in these Western economies, especially the US and Canada, to innovate and create. And there's never been a better time for that, and so I love, working with people that are interested in that, intrigued by that. And there was an article in the Wall Street Journal last week about how people in their 70s are now becoming a real player in the startup demographic. I mean, who would have ever thought that 50 years ago, right? So I think it's so much about mentality. It's just like you said, I'm going to live forever. I'm already proving it, right? I love it. And I like to point out to people, we've got the Rolling Stones for Pete's sake. I mean, good Lord, I want to see what I thought was going to be their last tour ever in like 1989. They're still out there touring and making music. I was watching a show with my wife recently, and there was a cameo. It was like a cooking show. It was a cameo from Mel Brooks, and he's 99. And he's working on a reboot of The Producers, and he looked fantastic. And I thought, man, I'm sitting here at 59. What if I had 40 great years in front of me, right? I don't think many of us think 99 and think I'm jamming, but he was jamming, and so it's possible, right? There's proof. Now people might say, well, he's rich and famous, and I'm like, well. So we're a lot of people in this sad 27 club, like Kurt Cobain and Janis Joplin. And if it was rich and famous was all there was to it, rich and famous people would live forever. It's clearly not that. I think what it is people feel like they've identified what their life's work is. And so that's a big distinction we try to make is redefining this four-letter word of work, right? Because it is so exhausting for people now, and so transactional. And when they leave corporate careers, professional careers, they are exhausted and they can't really get behind the idea of doing that for another 20 or 30 years. And the first thing that I say is, you're absolutely right. You should not do that. And you probably can't do that. You probably won't have 20 or 30 years in front of you if you keep trying to do that. So we have to figure out more of this idea of what life's work looks like, right? And the second book that I would highly recommend is From Strength to Strength by Arthur Brooks. And that was the book that gave me the understanding of our two types of intelligence. We have crystallized intelligence, we have fluid intelligence. And fluid is what we have in droves when we're young, right? We're firing on all cylinders. I equate it to taking a regulatory exam, right? You're 25 years old, you take that in your sleep, right? 55 years old, it's going to take some time to get ready for that, right? And it's not that we can't do it, it's that that's our fluid intelligence. It declines, it starts declining for everybody in our 30s, and it continues to decline for the rest of our lives. And that's why a lot of times the stuff that requires a lot of cerebral focus and energy for things that we're not inherently interested or good at take a lot more effort. And it's a big part of the burnout epidemic. People are stuck in fluid intelligence careers and they've aged to a point where their fluid intelligence has declined. But there's also crystallized intelligence, which is your accumulated wisdom and expertise and experience and judgment, your ability to synthesize, see the big picture, connect disparate things. It's all those things that your kids think you're a wizard, right? And it's because you've been there and you can see the whole thing. And that is immensely valuable. And that's the type of work that we want to orient towards, this crystallized intelligence work, mentoring, advising, consulting, doing the things that call upon, this wisdom of the elders that we all have, and creating a career for ourselves, however we're going to define what career means, that takes advantage of that and gets us out of this grinding, exhausting work that, nobody should keep doing for, their 60s and 70s.
Right. I will say that. I mean, I think Mel Brooks is an outlier, but you're
He
hearing
is an
more and
outlier.
more of those people,
Yeah.
their late 70s into their 80s, still producing, still vital, still doing all sorts of stuff. And
Yeah.
so they are no longer outliers. It used to be
Yeah.
if you saw, a woman at age 70 lifting weights, she was an outlier, but oh, I
Yes.
could never do that. But
Right.
now they are no longer outliers. And this
Yeah.
might be a good segue into, can you define or give us your definition for encore career?
Yes. There's some criterion that I think establish it. You mentioned about, putting on a red vest and working in a hardware store, and I think there's nothing wrong with that on earth. I just wouldn't con consider that to be an encore career. I would think that's more something to do, as you said, where
Oh, it's just a job,
something to do, and then you go home, and you have to think about it. I totally get that. There are many days that I kind of covet that. But an encore career is really one that challenges you, and it pushes you to keep growing and learning, and becoming a better version of yourself. For me, it's about identifying a part of our process is helping you identify things that put you in flow states, and then identify, as the psychologist Gay Hendricks called, your zone of genius, right? The things that just come so naturally and effortlessly for you that you don't even consider them to be talents because they're just easy, but other people do, right? And that's what they come to you for. And so let's surface that stuff and build around that. And that becomes a big part of the foundation of an encore career and not just going someplace to pass some time and make some money, right? The big keywords that we use are agency and autonomy. And that's, it's autonomy is the freedom to do what you want to do, and agency is having the resources to make it happen, right? And it doesn't necessarily mean financial resources. It can mean time, it can mean capability, but it's the ability to bring it to fruition. And so that is a big part of being fulfilled with the work you're doing. In this third act is feeling like it's work you're choosing to do, right? And this is what I'm doing with Encore Career Lab is, I guess, a startup in a way. And there's a lot that goes with it. And there are days that I wake up and I'm tired, and and it feels like work sometimes mentally. And then I'm like, I'm choosing to do this. I want to do this, right? And it's, I think that's important, that it just doesn't feel like I have to. And that's where we have the ability to keep doing it and do it well beyond what we would have considered the age of work in generations past, right? So I think that that's really important. And I think getting back into community doesn't have to be a huge community, but being connected, Not being isolated, that has a huge impact on mortality. I think it's like a 15% lower risk of all-cause mortality if you have a sense of meaning and purpose in your life and you're connected. It's loneliness has a higher mortality risk than smoking, which is a pretty shocking thing. And so, I think the bottom line is it's the get out of bed in the morning thing, right? You might have to get out of bed for your tea time, but it's the world's going to stay on its axis if you don't, right? But you need to, that thing that you feel like I got to get out of bed because these people that I care about need me to do that thing I do, you know?
Now, you have the Encore Career Lab. If it's a lab, is there a formula for this, or oh,
Yeah, it's
I didn't
no, you
expect that
called
casual
them.
about
Well, it's I haven't quite figured out how to describe it, except lab, I guess, captures what I was going for. It's you could call it a mastermind, you could call it a boot camp, but really what it's designed to do, it's 12 weeks. It's online and it's a combination of self-study using a curriculum that essentially I've created, drawing on a lot of resources like two of the ones I just mentioned, the books I just mentioned, other things that really were an influence to me, and then other things I realized we were missing in wealth management that I wanted to work into this program. So there's kind of a progressive framework that people go through, and it starts with the why and then the what. And then the how, right? So Simon Sinek's Start With Why book. I definitely think that's where we start. Because if you're not clear on your why, the what can you can go wrong on the what at this age. Because we just are not going to put up with the same stuff we put up with when we were younger. And sometimes we don't know it till we get in it. And then we're like, oh yeah, I'm not doing this. And you just have to back out, right? And so, we didn't have that luxury when we were 30. So that's why we get really clear on, this why part of this and your flow states, your zone of genius, all of that. Then we get into the what, the vision and strategy. And then we get into the how, which is kind of getting going, right? There's a lot of inertia, a lot of imposter syndrome as we get older. Our inner critic's like, eh, it's not us. Come on, let's stay where we're safe, right? We don't want to put ourselves out there in a weird way, and it'll just start chirping at us. And so we work on doing small, low risk things, right? If you want to, be a consultant, get a couple of clients and, don't charge them anything or charge them $500 or something and do it and see how it goes and tell them it's a beta test. And, and if you want to be a writer, write a couple of articles. You don't have to write the great American novel. And, there are ways to do what we call this, it wasn't my term, but I love the term portfolio of small bets, right? You try different things, you see what resonates, and then you go all in when you find something that resonates with you and resonates with people who need you. That's when you go all in, but you don't try to figure all that out first before you get started. Then that's where the analysis paralysis comes in. And so that's what the curriculum is designed to do. It's online, people do it on their own time. And then there's a group component to it. We had one yesterday, some new folks that have come into the program, and it's, six, seven, eight people in a cohort. And it's good to be back in community. And it's good to be around people that help us realize that this is not our personal failing, that we can't figure this out, that this is a very unique challenge that we're facing demographically. Just what we said, our grandparents didn't even consider what we're facing, right? Which is, what am I going to do? How am I going to reinvent myself? And so we tend to be at this phase of life thinking, oh, I thought I was going to have everything figured out. I'm kind of embarrassed I don't, right? I mean, my kids and my colleagues kind of think that I do. I don't want to tell anybody I can't figure out what to do. And we go internal and we kind of suffer in silence. So I think it's really important to be back around other people where we realize that it's this time of life. It's not us, it's nothing we're doing. But we need to be in community to help figure that out. And there's a lot of energy and kind of cross-pollination that comes from being in a group setting where people have ideas and friendships develop, and it gets well beyond anything that I'm bringing to the group, And then the third is the one-on-one coaching, where I think it's important to shape the outcomes specifically to what your clients are looking for and how their path evolves. with a coach, with me or some of our clients are graduating and becoming coaches in the program, which is really gratifying to me. And so that I think is the idea of the lab, right? You come in, you kind of immerse yourself in this thinking and this kind of self-reflection for part of it, and then the vision and strategy, getting this clarity about your future self, which the research shows is really important. We have a compelling vision of our future self to pull us forward. And then, you get a mission and a vision and an action plan that you're coming out of this. And I'm not, suggesting that in 12 weeks it's going to be handed to you on a silver platter or a tablet from Mount Sinai, but it gives you the confidence to get going. And I think that's really what it is. It's so much confidence and mindset. And if we feel like we know our core values, we know our priorities, and I think really importantly, we know our non-negotiables for this phase of life, then we feel more confident moving forward, and then we get momentum, we get going, and we feel excited and optimistic. And I tell our people, that are working with us, it's like we're a hope program, right? I mean, this is, we have to give people this sense that there is another alternative to decay and decline, and that's really what we're championing.
Now, you just use the word mindset. It's a word that does get bounced around a lot these days. Now, you suggest there's perhaps one really important mindset shift. What is that? Or do we
I
have to
think
pay
it's,
for that information?
no, I think it's rejecting this idea that decay and decline is inevitable. And we, well, I mean, it is inevitable ultimately. We're mortal, right? But I mean, that we turn an age and now we're getting old, right? And it's, it was modeled for us by prior generations, right? And they were kind of in the last part, but we're not now. At least there's a high likelihood we're not, right? We may have decades remaining, and when we're 60 years old, there's a life expectancy of 85, a 50-50 shot of making it to 90, and that's just going to get longer, right? So I think we just have to reject this whole decay and decline mentality. I remember I was fortunate enough to get to play golf with Bernie Marcus, the founder of Home Depot, one of the founders, before he passed away. He was late 80s, and it was a charity thing, and I just happened to get paired up with him. And he was just a really gracious, fascinating person. And, I remember him saying, I go to the country club to play golf with my friends, and some of them are 10 years younger than me, and they look 10 years older than me. And yes, Bernie was a billionaire and rich, all that stuff, but it was that sense of purpose. He was doing initiatives all the time. He was doing things that move the needle for people. He felt like he was doing stuff that helped people. And when you embrace this decline mentality, it makes you self-centered, right? You kind of get focused on your own self and your own issues and your decline and things like that. So I think if there's a mindset thing, I think it's just saying, I'm not feeling it. I'm not buying into that. And, when it's my time, I guess it'll be my time, but I'm going all in until then, right?
Well, I know I have conversations with, both personally, because I've always worked, well, for a whole bunch of years, I've worked in elder care and dementia care. But I think whether you're talking, your brain's possibilities or your physical possibilities, is it's super easy to default at this
Yes.
age to, oh, it's old age setting in. I mean, if a 25-year-old forgets something or a 25-year-old has a knee issue, they just go, well, damn, or well, whatever, and perhaps at this age, if I forget something or my knees are bothering me, I do work really hard at saying, well, damn, but a lot of people will say, oh, I'm getting old.
Yeah, it's the default, just like you said. And it's part of the communal griping, right? I mean, it's kind of tongue in cheek a little bit, But the thing is, your subconscious is always listening, right? It's running in the background all the time. And the things that you verbalize, it's internalizing, and it's assuming that what you're saying must be true, right? And so then you get in these, loops between your subconscious, which is like 90% of your thinking is subconscious. And it starts to guide your behavior, and it starts to manifest in maladies, right? And then some of them are visit illness, things we didn't do for sure, but definitely our mindset, it's been shown over and over again, has a huge impact on how, resilient we are as we age. And so I think that is so much of what's tied in to the holistic part of what we're trying to do is to get people, I call it the decline railway, which is not properly pronounced, but an incline railway goes up, a mountain in little steps and increments, right? And that's how we go down the mountain is little steps. We start buying into it. And I know we've all seen it, right? And so, what I like to say is that we are a ticket off the decline railway. And that's really what I think our mission is.
That sounds good. I was thinking about you the other day, just prepping for our chat, and one of your talking points is how can listeners take the first step toward designing a life they're excited to wake up to every day. Now, I think you were explaining the lab, and I think that was part of it. The other day, I was listening to a very successful author speak, and he was asked how people could start to pursue their dream. The first thing he said is put down the phone and turn off the TV. Now, going back to that 4.3 hours a day of TV watching we mentioned earlier, that's 30 hours a week, and that's a pretty good start. What would you add to that?
Yeah, and I think, for those of us who are, this generation, younger boomers, older Gen Xers, certainly it's going to be the ones behind us. It's going to be our phones, not our TVs so much, right? An endless source of distraction for us. I think what I find is that the inertia sets in a lot faster than we might think. And once you lose that action taking muscle that a lot of us had when we were working or when we were parenting, it starts to atrophy. And that's when the decline kind of kicks in. And so I think we have to be aware of this temptation to just go with the comforting thought, stuff, whether it's surfing on our phone or doing nothing but recreating, not recreating, but nothing but recreating. And then a lot of times the drinking follows, and that's just sort of the natural progression. And that's when it all kind of starts to, spiral down. And so I think we have to be intentional about recognizing those lures, those temptations, and saying, you know what, I've got other things I want to do. I may not have figured it out yet, but that's my intention, right? And I'm going to put some effort into this. And it doesn't have to be grandiose, it doesn't have to be writing a novel or, all these kind of ridiculous things the financial services industry puts out there, that makes you feel like you've got to do these glorious, bucket list things all the time. It can just be something that means something to you and some other people that you care about. But it should be something that calls on the highest and best use of yourself. And you mentioned the dementia and this whole idea of neuroplasticity, where our brains keep growing and developing the rest of our lives if we keep challenging our brains. And there's a lot of evidence out there that continuing to do meaningful work that challenges you and keeps you growing and learning has a significant impact on your likelihood of having dementia, and can really stave it off. And I'm happy to put that some of that in your show notes too. But so there's a real quality of life aspect to this too. If we kind of reject that comfort at all costs mentality and this sort of divine right we have that we've paid our dues and now it's our time to recreate for the rest of our lives, we're kind of only fooling ourselves ultimately.
Yeah, I'll add in too here that I can't remember your exact words, but when you're younger and you're parenting and you've got a business, you're sort of you take the bull by the horns, like you just get in there and do stuff. I have just in the last couple of weeks gotten into AI, and the questions that I was asking it and the scenarios that I was running were about the podcast here, and the AI was coming up with this stuff that I'm going, oh my God, I would never have thought of that. What a great idea. And so then it was like, I realized that it was only a few years ago when I was getting going on all this that, I mean, if I had to burn the midnight oil, so be it. But in the last year or so, with my lifestyle, things have relaxed. I put my feet up in the evening. I've got an app that I do on my phone or on my tablet. And I'm thinking, okay, let's go
Right.
back a few years. Let's get rid of the app off the tablet, put the tablet on the charger for the evening,
Yep.
and let's do this stuff that has excited me so much. You know,
Yeah.
so it does take that oomph, that self-realization, and then that self-drive, which
It
I'm just
does.
getting into. So.
Well, and you know, part of the weird challenge we have as, you know, people living in this time is that we're not bored the way that we were 50 years ago, right? Like, I'm convinced the pyramids were built because people were bored. You know, there's nothing to do, so let's build some pyramids, right?
So let's throw around
Yeah,
some 10-ton bricks.
let's really go for something here. You know, now our devices slice and dice things to the nth degree so that they serve us up exactly what we're interested in at all times. And it keeps us hooked into it, right? You know, it used to be 50 years ago, we all watched, you know, Jeopardy or something, right? You know, or we all watched Lawrence Welk or whatever that was when we were kids. And, you know, our Saturday cartoons were very, you know, there weren't a lot of options, and we all just kind of watched it, but none of it was really like what we chose. It was what was available. And there was a time where we would just say, I gotta go do something, and we'd just walk away and we'd go. If we were kids, we'd go outside and play, right? But now our phones and our devices keep us entertained with stuff we're uniquely interested in all day long if we want. And so that I think is a huge challenge for people as they move into this phase of life, coupled with the attitude of it's my time to be comfortable and recreate. You know, I think it's all a balance, and it can get out of balance in a hurry, to your point. I think I totally understand what you're saying about deleting the app and putting it, you got to put a little friction in between it, right?
I was going to ask you a question, and it's gone. Doesn't matter. and it's not old age.
No.
what haven't I asked you that you would like mid-age people, mostly women, to think about as they are looking at really finding something that lights them up in these years?
A couple things. One is don't underestimate yourself. And I see this with my wife. I see this with my daughter. They have incredible things to offer, and they have done incredible things. My daughter, I mentioned, I think we were offline, is a teacher. And you know, so I'm not saying she's not doing things. I'm just saying that what I see is women in particular underestimate their ability sometimes about what they're capable of and what the world would value from them. And so to me, it's an exciting time to really kind of blue sky what you could do, what's interesting, you know, bring a little process to it. But, you know, don't limit yourself. It doesn't have to be practical. It doesn't have to be something that's, you know, a variant of what you did if you did have a career. It could be something completely new. And so let it be fun. And, you know, one of my clients is a retiring general from the military, you know, and you know he has a term I love. It's strategic patience, and they have to exercise a lot of strategic patience in the military in campaigns and not just go the first thing they feel like doing. And I think that that is also what we need to bring to this phase of life. Let's be intentional about it. Let's be optimistic and confident, and then let's not put a bunch of pressure on ourselves to get it all figured out before we go do anything. Let's have some fun, take a little pressure off ourselves, and just go out and try stuff and just see where it goes, just for the fun of doing it.
I need to talk to any regular listeners right now that I have not arranged a fall theme where guests say, they conclude with saying, don't underestimate yourself. It's been happening a few times recently, and it's like, I agree 100%. It says yes. But it's just, it's, yeah, that's great. No, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. That's funny.
Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
The URL is EncoreCareerLab.com. And I'm on LinkedIn as well. If you Google or go to LinkedIn, it's Jack Calhoun, Encore Career, you should find me. Feel free to shoot me an email at jack@EncoreCareerLab.com and
Perfect.
they will get me.
Okay, may I ask you a personal question before we close?
I think I love it. We'll see what the question
Well, you've already mentioned it. You opened by mentioning it, so I almost started our conversation with a laugh.
I'm ready for it.
Does a degree in journalism and mass communication, no matter how old it is, help you now getting your new message out?
I made a great decision in college in hindsight, and that was I pivoted from being a radio, TV, film major to a newspapers major, which sounds funny because now newspapers are pretty much done. But it taught me the fundamentals of editing and succinct communication. And those are things that cross every platform, every strata. And so I am very grateful for that foundation that helped me figure out how to be an effective communicator in pretty much anything I've done. So I am grateful for that experience. It's helped me, and it certainly helps me today.
Now, just as you said that, it occurred to me when I read, first of all, mass communication, I was thinking sort of you communicating to the masses, but what it is dealing with those platforms that can communicate with the masses. So whether it's,
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And then, it's also just learning the fundamentals of how to structure, your thinking and don't bury the lead, as they used to say, right? Let's get the important stuff out at the top and let's talk about that. And just how to edit and just the fundamentals of grammar, which have just really declined in the last 20 years. It kills me, That's when I do have to tell myself not to talk about being old when I actually care about a semicolon versus a colon.
The Oxford comma.
Don't get me started on the Oxford comma.
No, that's a whole other conversation, and we're completely on the same page, I'm sure. Oh dear. Okay, so your website link is in the show notes. All of the links are on your page at our website. And yeah, if you can send me links to some of those books that you find really impactful, that would be fabulous.
Absolutely,
So,
we'll do it.
listeners, what are your thoughts on my conversation with Jack today? It's always interesting having a coach for a high achievers contact me because I'm anything but in most areas of my life. Some of you are, so talk to us. Although, Jack, in fairness, I think most of what you said, I got high achiever off your website and off your profile and things like that, but the rules apply across the board.
They do. They absolutely do. And part of that's just trying, to message to people that we think will be interested in working with us, but I think it's applicable to everybody.
Okay, so listeners, leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Was there a question I didn't ask, Jack? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Share this episode. We've just been discussing high achievers. Some of you are high achievers, and when you share this conversation with your friends or colleagues, you'll be doing all of you a favor. And maybe even birthing some interesting ideas. Am I fair to say that, Jack?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely.
If you enjoyed this conversation, click the follow button at your favorite podcast platform. It helps us grow. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free. You get notified every time an episode is released. A reminder to check out the resource tab at boomwithabang.com. You can look up previous podcast episodes by subject. You can find books written by guests. You can find some interesting courses and offerings, lists of age-appropriate job and philanthropic possibilities. And if you're at all curious about the life of a house slash pet sitter, I'm journaling that journey on the website too. Jack Calhoun, thank you for being my guest today. First of all, for reminding me that there are a lot of high-achieving boomer women out there, but sharing so many insights about going from drifting to designing. And those two words, just so that the listeners don't think I'm brilliant, those are your words.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Agnes. It's been great. I love what you're doing. I think you're walking the talk of what I'm talking about with your podcast here. So I salute you for that. And it's been a privilege to be on with you.
Well, it's been a delight. Thank you very much. Have a great rest of week.
Thank you, Agnes. Bye-bye.